This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 11 days into the Israeli-Hamas conflict in Gaza and no end in sight. So far, both sides say a ceasefire is only possible under terms that amount to victory for their side. Hamas gets political, financial, diplomatic, and military aid from Syria and Iran. Israel has enormous resources of its own and gets political, financial, diplomatic, and military support from the United States. Many around the world denounce the rockets Hamas launches into Israel, but decry what they describe as Israel's disproportional response. Not the U.S. The leaders of both political parties back Israel and the special relationship between Washington and Tel Aviv based on mutual security needs, shared cultural and political values. The United States also provides about $3 billion a year in military aid. Today we focus on the elements of U.S. influence on Israel, where interests coincide, where they divide, how and when U.S. leverage might be applied. Later in the program, the delicate issue of calling a friend in D.C. you haven't sent a Christmas card to in a while to ask for a place to sleep on Inauguration Day. But first, the U.S.-Israeli relationship. How much influence does the U.S. really have over Israel? How can it use that influence to shape Israeli policies? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation online. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Stephen Walt joins us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. He's a professor of international relations at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And it's nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here, Neil.
And when we talk of U.S. influence on Israel, what does that influence consist of beyond that $3 billion in military aid?
Well, the United States has long been Israel's most steadfast ally. I think it's the one country that the Israelis are very serious about trying to maintain a good relationship with. And because of the aid relationship and because of the many connections between the two societies, the United States has lots of potential influence over Israeli conduct if it chooses to exercise that influence. For the most part, the United States doesn't put much pressure on Israel. The aid tends to be given unconditionally, and as we've seen in the last 11 days, you rarely, if ever, see American politicians uttering more than the mildest criticisms. This is an unusual situation, to say the least, and I'd argue it's not good for the United States, but also not good for Israel either.
Well, let's get back into that potential influence. How could U.S. Those levers be used?
There's a whole variety of different ways they can be used. I mean, people often talk in very stark terms about, you know, well, the United States should simply cut off all aid to Israel. I think that in most cases, that's too much. That's a sort of too harsh a response to many issues of difference. The way to think about this, it seems to me, is about the United States simply having a more normal relationship with Israel, instead of a special relationship, one where when they were doing things that we thought were in our interest and in their interest, we would support them. But when they were doing things that the United States was opposed to, like, say, building settlements in the West Bank, the United States would be able to distance itself from Israel, might be able to reduce some of that support or make it conditional, and also simply have a much more candid conversation, both in public and in private, with what American policy is and what American support was going to be.
Special relationship. The United States enjoys special relationships with two countries, Britain and with Israel.
That's right. Although in the case of Britain, first of all, it wasn't always that way. We had a not very close relationship throughout much of the 19th century. And the special relationship doesn't involve the United States giving, you know, large amounts of direct economic and military aid and giving that unconditionally. USA to Israel is about $500 per year for every Israeli, plus we give them consistent diplomatic and military support. Again, there you can defend that in a variety of ways, but the big problem is that the aid tends to be given unconditionally, as I said before, even when Israel is doing things that aren't good for us and ultimately aren't good for them.
Where do Israel's are Israel's interests and American interests congruent? Do they are there some cases they're clearly the same, but in other cases, do they divide?
Well, the most obvious one is the settlement policy. I mean, many Israelis will tell you that the entire effort to colonize the West Bank with a series of settlements over the last 40 or 50 years was a strategic disaster, a strategic error of really quite enormous proportions, even leading Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert now to question the whole enterprise as threatening the long-term future of the Jewish state. The United States would have been a better friend to Israel if it had consistently oppose that and use the leverage at its disposal to try and bring an end to the settlement process. That would make a two-state solution easier now. That would have, I think, made it less likely that groups like Hamas would have achieved the popularity that they have achieved. It would have been better for us, better for Israel, ultimately, I think, better for the Palestinians as well. But we didn't do that because, again, we have a special relationship and it's politically very difficult for American politicians to take a more independent stance, even though this is an issue where the Israeli government's policies and American interests are really at odds.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Aaron David Miller, author of The Much Too Promised Land. He's been a Middle East advisor to six secretaries of state from both Republican and Democratic administrations, now a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars here in Washington. It's nice to have you back on the program.
Pleasure to be here, Neil.
And when we talk about U.S. influence over Israel, you've been in the position of trying to actually flip those levers from time to time. How easy is it?
It's very difficult. It's difficult because of domestic politics, for sure. It's difficult because America's relationship with a close ally, and Israel is a close ally, is a complex one. And you never want to humiliate or, if at all possible, pressure or sanction an ally, lest you weaken your own policies and undermine your general approach. And then there's the relationship between presidents and Israeli prime ministers, which tend to be very close. American presidents end up being in the thrall of Israeli prime ministers. I talk about the notion of the Jewish lobby of one, which is the impact that an Israeli prime minister has on an American president. That's frankly much more consequential than the vaunted pro-Israeli lobby, which constrains American policy. So it's complex. My basic argument is that when a willful president in the service of American national interests, in discrete circumstances, when pressure essentially can actually produce something, American presidents can be plenty tough. I use Nixon and Kissinger, Jimmy Carter, and George H.W. Bush and Jim Baker as three examples of situations where American pressure defied not only domestic political pressures, but in the service of American diplomacy and also in the service of Israeli and American interests, actually succeeded.
We were talking with Stephen Walt about the special relationship. He believes it should be a more normal relationship.
Well, that's not my view. I think that it shouldn't be exclusive. I mean, the special relationship with Israel is driven by shared values. And I know shared values is considered to be a soft and somewhat idealized concept in foreign policy among realists. But the fact is, shared values is extremely important. We want to promote and support societies that share our values because there are too few of them. What we can't allow to have happen, and what I'm afraid has happened for 16 years now, eight under Bill Clinton and eight under George W. Bush, is that the special relationship has gotten out of control. It's become exclusive. We don't criticize the Israelis for things they do. We road test every idea with them before we show it to the other side. And we tend to acquiesce and agree in Israeli ideas like Camp David, for example, of July in 2000, which was not sufficiently prepared. So as a consequence of all this, we are empathetic and reassuring, but we're not tough enough. And my advice to Barack Obama, unsolicited, of course, is that you be tough, smart, and fair. If you're that, you may actually get in the game.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our guests are Stephen Walt and Aaron David Miller. We're talking about U.S. leverage on Israel, what it is and how to use it. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Kevin. Kevin with us from Fall River, Massachusetts.
Hello, yes. I think that we should possibly provide grants instead of loans that we then forgive, and therefore have a mechanism by now of eliminating any condition on those loans, and they're not truly loans if they're forgiven later. And the other issue is that I'm very, very pro-Israel, and that the best thing Israel needs is an autonomous, independent United States that can work with Israel as a good cop, bad cop deal. Put pressure on Israel and make it possible for Israeli politicians to do the right thing, to end the occupation and not militarize, attempt to use military means almost exclusively to try to resolve their security problems. Not unlike the neoconservatives. You know, they said they did the Iraq war because of America, for the United States. But that's not the case. It's similar that what Israel's more right-wing militaristic policy has done. They say that it's to defend Israel, but in reality, in the long term, it's undermined Israeli security. So we need an autonomous, independent United States that can call Israel into question for its own sake as well as ours.
Well, let me ask Aaron David Miller about the first element of what Kevin's talking about. What are the components of U.S. aid to Israel? How is it supplied? And I know $1 billion of it comes under the treaty from Camp David, the agreement with Egypt.
Yeah, I mean, the economic assistance the Israelis has more or less zeroed out. It's really a question of military assistance and help we provide with research and development for weapons. Israel's a non-NATO ally as well, and they derive benefits from that. You know, on the issue of American independence, I do believe that if America is to be a credible, effective mediator, it does need a certain measure of independence with respect to Israeli policy. Otherwise, how can we truly be viewed as effective? And by the way, we're not an honest broker. I mean, I've long ago surrendered that notion. We'll always be closer to Israel for the reasons that I laid out. The real question is, can we be an effective broker? And when we're tough, smart, and fair with the Israelis and the Arabs, I believe we can.
Honest broker, Stephen Walt, quickly.
There have been a few moments in the past, not in the recent past, where the United States has acted a bit more like an honest broker. And Aaron referred to, for example, President Bush, number 41, who did, at one point made loan guarantees conditional on an Israeli halt to settlements. The problem there, of course, is that the pressure tends not to be sustained for very long. And under the whole entire Oslo process, the United States continued its aid and Israel continued to build settlements. I mean, I think that I can't disagree with the idea of being tough, smart, and fair. The question is whether or not President Obama is going to be able to sustain the kind of dialogue and the kind of pressure that's going to be necessary to get the situation to change.
Kevin, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about the influence the U.S. has over Israel and how it might use that leverage. More with Stephen Walt and Aaron David Miller in just a moment. More of your calls as well. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice meets today with Arab and European leaders at the UN, hoping to bring an end to the fighting between Israel and Hamas as soon as possible. A spokesman for the State Department says Secretary Rice is working to broker a ceasefire that is both sustainable and durable. Our focus this hour is on the relationship between the United States and Israel. How much influence does the U.S. really have over Israel? How can it use that leverage to shape Israeli actions? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are Stephen Walt, professor of international relations at Harvard, co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Also with us, Aaron David Miller, an advisor to six secretaries of state on Arab-Israeli negotiations and author of the book The Much Too Promised Land. Let's go to another caller. This is Sam. Sam with us from Dearborn in Michigan.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call this afternoon. And I'd like to ask your guests if they could comment perhaps on why it is the United States seems to have such an inverse relationship as far as policy decisions and influence that it seems to be in a position to exert with Israel on behalf of either their interests or perhaps an equitable solution to the conflict overall. But I think there's a darker issue here, and I don't say that in the sense that it's nefarious by any means. But why is it that it's not brought to the attention of the general media or the public or the international community as the impact or the weight that perhaps a mechanism that the Israelis have devised over the last few decades of lobbyists and influence groups in within Washington, where it's created a climate of fear, if you will, among U.S. policymakers and politicians, that any dissension or any kind of strong condemnation against Israel for any actions that they're taking seems to be subdued because of their fear of backlash or retribution by, let's say, AIPAC or the Israeli lobby in this country.
Darker than Sam in the sense of opaque.
Well, in a sense, yes.
Okay. Also, well, let's go to Stephen Walt, who wrote a book on this very point.
First of all, I would correct one thing you said. I don't think this is something created by the Israelis. This is a domestic special interest group in the United States, and that's a perfectly legitimate form of democratic politics. I mean, people in the United States can organize to lobby and push politicians and put pressure on media organizations. That's the way our system of government works. And I think the reason we have the special relationship with Israel is not, as Aaron said, primarily due to shared values. There are some shared values, but, you know, there are lots of countries that share American values, and we don't have special relationships with all of them. We have a special relationship because there's a well-organized set of interest groups here. And I think the unfortunate part is that many of them, and particularly the most powerful ones, groups like AIPAC, have advocated a set of policies over the years that have been unintentionally quite harmful to Israel and to the United States alike. And, you know, I think Aaron and I might actually agree on some of those policy questions. But I think unless you get an American president who's willing to confront them, and I might add, as we start to get, I think, a much more heterogeneity among Israel supporters, more people realizing that the policies we have followed and the policies Israel have followed have been counterproductive, then I think you do have the potential for a real change that would be good for all of us.
Aaron David Miller?
Well, I would argue that lobbies lobby is not surprising or stunning. I mean, it read the Constitution. I mean, this is a system designed by the founders with shared and also separated powers. The founders may have been suspicious of interest groups, but what's happened clearly is that you have a number of very well-organized and affluent lobbies that seek to make their points. I don't find that so remarkable. What's remarkable is that presidents don't lead. That's the question. And Americans elect their presidents to lead. When, in fact, presidents do lead, Nixon, Carter, and George H.W. Bush, it seems to me we can be successful. I would disagree with Stephen on one issue, however. I think Israel is unique in the sense that there's a confluence of factors that come together. There's no question that the presence of 5.5 million American Jews, and I might add joined by millions of evangelical Christians, who support Israel not just for eschatological reasons, because they believe that Israel, right or wrong, correct or incorrect, appears more like America than much of the Arabs and Arab and Muslim world. That has a profound importance. If you took away shared values, if you took away that the image in most American minds that Israel is a small country, however powerful it may be, living in a dangerous neighborhood, that it wasn't a democracy, that it wasn't based on liberal humanistic traditions, then I think no amount of lobbying in the world by a pro-Israeli lobby in the United States could deliver the way the U.S.-Israeli relationship has turned out. The one thing you cannot take away and have the relationship prosper is what I call value affinity, the notion that Israel and America share common values. That is critical to understanding the nature of this relationship.
Sam, thank you. I'm sorry, Steve Walt, did you want to come back?
Well, again, I think that, again, there is something in what Aaron just said, but I think there are also some pretty distinct differences between the United States and Israel. Our values are not completely congruent. The United States is a liberal democracy, a melting pot democracy, where people of all religions and ethnicities are supposed to enjoy equal rights. Israel is not a melting pot democracy. It's explicitly created as a Jewish state, and there are other countries around the world who are like that, but there's a difference between their democracy and our democracy. And of course, Israel is not a democracy for all of the Palestinians under its control. There's a sharp difference in American values there, yet that's not a difference that gets manifest very often in American political debate, and certainly not something that the average congressman or even the average executive branch official raises with the Israelis very often, and certainly doesn't complain about in public and doesn't make an issue of real political leverage.
I would only respond, Steve, by saying one thing. If you took a look at America in 1836, 60 years after the Declaration of Independence was signed, you would find a polity which disenfranchised blacks, were slaves, women. In fact, not all males, white males, could vote. Israel's 60 years old. it's in an anomalous position. It will have to work through a number of issues for a young, struggling democracy, which took us, I might add, more than 200 years to work through. After all, we've elected Barack Obama to be the 44th president of the United States. That's an extraordinary transformational act. And you're right, Israel is not a democracy in the sense that we are, but it deserves our support nonetheless within reason as a consequence of the society that it has become.
Let's get Izzy on the line. Izzy calling us from West Point. Izzy, you there? All right, I guess Izzy has left us, and we should instead go now to Peter. Peter calling us from Berkeley, California.
Hi, I seem to have about 5 points here. I'll try to tick them off fast. Seems like value affinities have to be expanded and promoted to include everyone in the world. And the main value that should be shared is nonviolent means. So let's not use our other values to justify massive violence while condemning out of hand a relatively minor violence, which of course has this background of frustration where the disparity where Israel was created and supported and Palestine wasn't by the international community. So that same international community that created and recognized Israel is responsible for cleaning up this mess. And Israel and the U.S. with its leverage ought to go to the U.N., and the United Nations needs to become what it ought to be, a truly global democracy organization with authority behind it. And that's tough. That's a big change in the world. So this is birth pangs of a greater world.
Well, Peter, let's
learn how to fight fire with water.
All right, let's stop on those points. The United Nations, Stephen Walt, is that going to be an effective venue? It's hard to imagine the United States doing
that. I fear not. I think Aaron and I, in our own fashion, are trying to work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict here. I think adding to that the reform of the United Nations and turning it into a truly effective institution for global governance is too ambitious even for us.
And on the shared values, we're getting a lot of emails on this as well. Here's one from Hassan in California. What shared values? Israel does not have a constitution, has two sets of laws, one covering Jews and one covering non-Jews, not only in the occupied territories, but also inside Israel. Israel demolishes homes and villages of Bedouin in the Negev and Arabs in the Galilee to Judaize the entire country. President Carter correctly called this apartheid. You yourself drew a comparison to slavery, not obviously in a direct analogy. That was to you.
I mean, I think, as I pointed out, and I'm not going to defend the anomalies in the Israeli democratic polity, because there are many, and the Israelis are going to have to find a way to work through them, including the reality that a million Israeli citizens, roughly 20% of the population, suffer systemic social and economic discrimination, that is, Palestinian citizens of Israel or Israeli Arabs. But nonetheless, there you can probably count on one hand the number of emerging democracies who actually change power regularly according to democratic form and format, surrender power, in which there's a contract between the governed and the governed. I think in that particular case, it's extremely important to understand that shared value, fellow democratic polities abroad, particularly ones that are under tremendous stress. I mean, we have non-predatory neighbors to our north and south and fish to our east and west. We don't understand the existential dilemma, not just of the Israelis, but the small tribes, including the Arabs and the Palestinians, that live in that part of the world. So I believe on balance, and no country is perfect, that there is a case for shared values, and it's one that the vast majority of the American public, when they focus on this issue, appears willing to support.
Peter, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Stephen Walt, let me follow up with you. As a practical matter, what do you foresee? We do have a change of administration during the presidential election campaign. Barack Obama appeared before the AIPAC and said that he was going to support Israel, the same as every other presidential candidate has vowed to do so in my lifetime, to my memory. Do you think things will change?
I wish I could say they were, but I don't think so. I think part of it is that Obama is going to have an enormous amount on his plate already. with the situation in the American economy, with the problems we still face in Iraq, with the continued problems in Afghanistan, with Pakistan and India and elsewhere. So he's got a very full agenda, and he's going to be told by a lot of his advisors that that Israel-Palestine is just too hard. Now, it's possible that what's happening in Gaza today is going to force that to the front of his agenda right from the very beginning, and you might see more engagement. The question is, are we going to get engagement that's really effective here? And I think that's going to involve him talking very tough in private to Israeli interlocutors and to appointing a special envoy that has real credibility with both sides there. It's going to involve making some public statements similar to, say, the speech that Secretary of State James Baker made to AIPAC back in the early 90s, where he said it was time to give up the dream of greater Israel. That's going to involve engaging with the more progressive parts of the American Jewish community and other groups that are supportive of Israel, but not blindly supportive. And you can then imagine a series of other steps that could be taken to, designed to convey it. Last but not least, I think the United States has to lay out, as President Clinton did in his last month in office, his own or our own vision of what a just settlement is. That's not dictating a settlement to the parties, but it's laying out what we think a fair outcome is here. And again, we're not doing that in an anti-Israeli spirit. We're doing that in a pro-Israeli spirit. We're recognizing that, as Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said a year or so ago, that if the two-state solution fails, Israel will face a South Africa-style struggle. And then he added, if that happens, the state of Israel is finished. So in a funny way, if President Obama is a true friend of Israel, he will actually adopt a more even-handed position and use the leverage at his disposal to try and bring about a solution that would be in everybody's best interest.
We're talking about the U.S.-Israeli relationship with Stephen Walt and Aaron David Miller. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Aaron David Miller, it's not just the U.S. which is changing administrations. It's to be an election in Israel in February with every possibility that they could have a new, well, certainly a new parliament and probably a new prime minister.
Actually, Neil, that I think is a critical point, because leadership on all sides is going to be absolutely essential in order to make anything happen. And here's where I think I'm very pessimistic. You have a Palestinian national movement that is dysfunctional and broken and divided. You have an Israeli government that has shown us three Israeli prime ministers, none of whom have been terribly successful. And that leaves an American president, and I agree with Steve Wald on this, an American president who understands that governing is about choosing. He's not the war president. He's not the peace president. He's the fix America's broken house president. I voted for Barack Obama, and I'll vote for him again in 2012, whether or not he engages on the Arab-Israeli issue, because his real mandate, and this is where Steve Wald, I think, is absolutely right, his real mandate is to fix this economy, keep America secure, and provide some measure of hope that the future that he's inheriting will be brighter 4 years from now. So governing is about choosing. He'll manage this. He has a very able Secretary of State who will probably create an empire of process with very talented, very smart envoys. Whether or not he's prepared to be tough, smart, and fair, I guess we're just going to have to wait and see.
Let me ask you also another point. You talked about the U.S. influence on Israel and the difficulty of actually employing those levers. Does Israel, sometimes people have the impression that Israel clears its plans in advance with the United States, provides information ahead of time so that it can get U.S. support. Is that always the case?
Not always. I think the Israelis don't want to be crosswise with us, particularly when it concerns consequential acts they might take. For example, a military strike on Iran. They can't do that without American support, at least acquiescence. So that's clearly an example of something they'd have to come to us with. No, by and large, Israel wants to be in the same boat as America. My only point is, let's try to make sure that boat isn't leaking, and that it essentially has a port, a good navigator, and a reasonably calm sea so that we can make some progress. And I do believe, despite all of my skepticism, that Barack Obama has the necessary skills, the smarts, the discretion, and the toughness to actually be a good negotiator. He simply has to make one decision. Does he believe the pursuit of Arab-Israeli peace is a high priority for the United States? If he does, good things can happen.
And Stephen Walt, do you see that there is at least the beginnings of a lobby group to promote the Palestinian side, the Arab side, if you will?
There are some rather politically weak groups that attempt to do that. I think what is more interesting is the growing emergence of, as I said before, heterogeneity within the ranks of Israel supporters. The new group J Street, for example, would be an example of that. And I think we also see just a changed discourse here in the United States, not completely, not as much in the mainstream media, but elsewhere, people beginning to recognize that a more open discussion of this issue is ultimately going to lead to better policies from the United States and hopefully a better outcome over there. But I'm not too confident.
Thanks to you both, Stephen Walt, a professor of international relations at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, co-author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, with us today from member station WBUR in Boston. Here in Studio 3A in Washington, Aaron David Miller, a former advisor to six secretaries of state on Arab-Israeli negotiations, the author of The Much Too Promised Land. Thanks very much to you both. When we come back, the great search for an empty sofa for the inauguration and how to call a friend you haven't talked to for 10 years. This is NPR News. For many of those who live in the Washington area, right around November 5th, the phone started to ring. Family members, friends, in some cases people they hadn't gotten a Christmas card from in some years, all asking, what's up for the inauguration? Veronica Miller, writing for TheRoot.com, says the innocent opening line often ends with folks inviting themselves to your house and onto your sofa. Veronica Miller is here with us in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with
us. Thanks for having me.
And when was your first phone call?
It had to have been election night. It was election night. We're sitting there. I was sitting with a group of my best friends. We're sitting there watching the kids come out on stage, watching the victory speech, and then our phone started ringing. And it was our parents, and it was our aunts and uncles, and it was our friends. Like, so, this is so exciting. So, yeah, what's going on for our inauguration?
And it took you a while to realize what they meant was, who's on your couch?
Who's on your couch? Can I stay at your house? Can I come eat your food? Can I drop by? And it's gotten, it's since then. There's been a bunch of calls, IMs, emails, text messages, all of that.
So how many people are you expecting over for inauguration?
Well, we're expecting, I live with a roommate, and we're expecting three people between me and her. The key to this was that these were the three people who actually asked to stay with us, and they didn't just invite themselves. So I said, if you're kind enough to ask permission to stay here, you can stay here. The other thing is that there are three people who have either lived or been to D.C. before, because there's an issue with people who haven't been to the city before just coming in, and they don't know how to get around. They don't know how to get from point A to point B, and you might not, you know, be available to do that for them. You might have to work. You might have places to go yourself on Inauguration Day. So these are people that can get around themselves if need be.
But some people just called you up and said, we'll be over?
That was what happened to my roommate. She went home to St. Louis. I'm probably going to get her in trouble, so I'm not going to say her name. She went home to St. Louis for the holidays, and she sends me a text message saying that her aunt just informed her, me and my colleagues are coming over. We're just going to stop by until things get started. There will be five of us. We live in a very tiny apartment. So she was like, not cool, not going to happen.
Well, if you've received that call, if you've made that call, call and tell us about it. Obviously, there is some delicate questions about your relationships with your friends. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And, of course, there's only one person we could turn to for further advice on this point, and that's Ask Amy's Amy Dickinson. She's with us as well. Amy, nice of you to be with us. Happy New Year.
Hey, Happy New Year. And, Veronica, how big is your bathtub? Will it fit your mattress?
I can't even take a bubble bath. I have to curl my knees up, so it's not going to work.
Well, I'm tiny, actually. Listen, one thing I love about this is I lived in D.C. for years, and I was just talking to a friend of mine who also lives in a smallish apartment right in D.C., and she said to me, well, at this point, we're just using my place as, well, a staging area.
What do you do when, first of all, if you're on the receiving end of these self-invitations and requests, Amy?
Well, what I love was Veronica's roommate, according to Veronica's essay, which I read and really enjoyed, her roommate actually said to her, the relative who had basically announced that she was coming to stay, I think the roommate just said, no, that's not going to happen. I mean, when people are so bold, you get to match their boldness by being very, very direct. And also, Veronica, you know, and her roommate set a nice precedent by letting people stay there who had bothered to ask.
Yeah, that was
really important.
Yeah.
So prioritize who you're going to let in, maybe on that basis. But Amy, if you, people are on the other side, you know, sort of awkwardly going over to the phone and digging up somebody's phone number from some really old phone book that they've had in their dresser drawer for you know some years now, how do you go about making that that suggestion that maybe you could stay over at their house?
Well, what I really like is the idea of hello, asking, you know, and I think it's okay to pick up the phone and say, look, you know, it's been a while. How are you doing? Blah blah blah. Do you still live in D.C.? And if so, I'm thinking about trying to come to the inauguration. And do you have any ideas where I might stay? You know, I mean, just be very open about it. That's fine because it's, you know, if you are, then it's easy enough for somebody to say, you know, I don't have a place, but let me look around. I might know some. I mean, I have a friend who is renting her house for an ungodly sum of money to people. I mean,
there's,
you know, there's like money
it.
To be made here.
Veronica, is that happening?
Are we renting out our house?
Yeah.
No, because we don't have the room to, and I would like to stay in my bed. I have no place else to go that weekend.
There's that. Yeah,
yeah, but also, I maybe I'm that not as polite person who will say, I haven't heard from you in 5 years, so no. But
there is that awkward moment of Amy, you know, somebody calls and you know, well, that extra room I used to have, that's now filled with my twins who are 7 years old.
Right, exactly. And you know, but you know what? That's good. I mean, one thing I really like about Veronica's behavior through this is she's just being very, very straightforward with all of these people who are being quite assuming, you know.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Jody's on the line from Denver.
Hi.
Hi, Jody.
You know, after Obama was elected, I emailed a good friend of mine from graduate school who lives in D.C. now with her family, seeing if I could invite myself over. And she was very gracious, but said she already had 20 people staying in her home, 8 of which were under the age of 8.
It sounds like, Jody, you probably didn't want to stay there.
She said we were welcome to come on any other time, but just not during the inauguration.
Yeah. No, I'm saying, and that's the thing. It's not, sometimes it's not necessarily the people who live here being mean or rude. It's just we're already booked up to say if you can book a couch. I have a friend that actually lives in Silver Spring, which is about 15 minutes up the street from here. And she has 8 people that have already signed up to stay in her place. It's going to look like, you know, a shelter for those couple of days.
Bunk bed sales must be going through the roof. Jody, did you find another place to stay?
You know, I decided that it was better just to sit on my nice comfy couch and watch via the television because I also have a 14-month-old that I didn't really feel like schlepping down to the mall to be able to watch. The other thing, too, is that, you know, living here in Colorado during the DNC, a lot of people made quite a bit of money by renting out their house.
And we recommend, in fact, you turn on the TV and turn off the sound and turn up the radio.
Will do.
Okay, Jody, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here's one from an email from Nicole in Baltimore. I had an ex-boyfriend who couldn't even find my contact information. He had to contact me via my MySpace account to ask me if he and his new girlfriend could come and stay at our house. And Amy, that seems a little beyond the pale.
Well, what, you know, that explains, I guess, why he's an ex. I mean, he's not even a very good ex. Boy, that's really nervy.
Let's go to Courtney. Courtney with us from Richmond in Virginia.
Yeah, hi. I was just going to comment that it's stunning how generous the offers were for, like, around the period of November 5th and on. As far as, yeah, you can stay at my place as opposed to those of us getting into it a little late right now and are a little bit less lucky as had we taken more foresight going into it around the 5th of November.
So you're looking you're still looking for a place in Washington.
I've got an offer, but I think I might have to kind of chill in the closet for a couple nights in order to get it all worked out.
Yeah, so. People think of Richmond as just down the road. It's a pretty far piece down
there.
My
major concern is actually getting into the District of Columbia. I'm fine as soon as I get there, but my major concern is getting in there around the 18th and 19th.
Traffic could be, well, of course, the day before, the Monday, is Martin Luther King holiday. So traffic shouldn't be particularly bad that day if you're just counting the people not going to work. There are a couple of other million people who may be arriving for the inauguration.
Yeah, I can imagine it's not going to be a fun trip.
It's going to be a nightmare.
All of them looking for a place to park.
Yep.
Courtney, thanks very much. Good luck.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to Margaret. Margaret with us from Oklahoma City.
Yeah, hi. I was calling in to comment that I know my aunt lives in D.C., and she's gotten my mom and grandma tickets for the past two inaugurations. So I called in dibs in August to, hey, if you can get me tickets, I want them. I don't care who's elected. Just I want to go. So, and that's how I'm getting up to the inauguration this year.
So, yeah, you were looking at the polls, or you were just taking a chance?
I was taking a chance. I really wanted to go and just be there for all the excitement. So.
Well, calling early, Amy, always recommended.
Exactly. And you know that caller, Courtney? I mean, would it kill him to put a little gift basket together? Would that kill him? Yeah, you had to get in on this very, very, very early, as Veronica knows.
And let me add, Amy, one of my friends who is staying with me, he's flying in from California. He's already offered to make breakfast for all of us who's in the house. So
there you go. And and you want, when you are staying overnight, especially in a small space, you want to be the best possible guest, and that means really be a no-trace camper, offer to cook, offer to clean up, and, you know, try and host your host for a meal.
Right.
Those of us in the Washington, D.C. area are regarding this as, in fact, the Washington, D.C. stimulus package. Margaret, thanks very much. Good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Constance in Lansing, Michigan. Lucky me, my godchild and her husband and children live in D.C. My sister and I are coming from Indiana and Michigan and getting to share the trundle bed of her daughter. We did get her permission. My nephew, my sister's son, is in the Culver Military Academy Black Horse Troop and will be in the inaugural parade. So my sister did approach the niece. They have a lovely home and are urban Obama fans. This is going to be fabulous. We're talking about the delicate issues raised by inviting yourself to crash at somebody's house in Washington for the inauguration. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our guests are Veronica Miller, who's a writer and radio producer, and Amy Dickinson, who writes the syndicated column Ask Amy for the Chicago Tribune. Let's get Andrew on the line. Andrew calling from Glastonbury, Connecticut.
Hi, I'm a GW student, and we have two friends staying with us in our prime real estate dorm in Foggy Bottom.
Foggy Bottom, a neighborhood in Washington, D.C., also the home of the State Department.
Yes, and the school said us that we can have guests, but it's conditional. So if there's a security problem, then they're out in the street, and we don't know what to do with our friends. So we're kind of nervous.
In other words, your friends are coming. They're coming with your permission, but they may be finding themselves sleeping in the subway.
Exactly.
Define security problem. Does that mean if they do something or something happens?
It's determined by the school. If the school thinks that there's a security threat on campus, then all of our guests are out in the street.
A security problem on campus, and who knows what that might be.
Right.
It could be a thousand different things.
But, I mean, you can imagine a school like GW, which is right down in the city in the thick of things, having perhaps even thousands of invited student guests could be a huge, huge problem.
I could only imagine what it's like at Howard, because I'm a Howard alum, mm-hmm. And Howard already has a problem when it comes to homecoming in October with people just, you know, flying in and staying in the dorms. So this has to be insane. I haven't even, you know, chatted with my sources there, so maybe I should talk them up and see what's going on.
Andrew, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
An email from David. I have some awesome, awesome friends who not only offered but insisted that we stay in their town D.C. apartment. They've even helped us make arrangements to find a place to park at the south end of the Yellow Line so that we don't have to drive into the city. Listening to your show, I feel lucky I have a place to stay and even luckier to have such great friends. The Yellow Line, one of the subway lines in Washington, D.C., and it goes out, there are big parking lots at the ends of it out in the suburbs where you can park your car. Let's see if we can get another caller in. This is Margaret. Margaret from Hartford,
yes,
Connecticut.
Hi.
Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I have got a phone call from a friend. He wanted to know if a friend of his and his wife could go and stay at my parents' house in Washington, D.C. I was raised in Washington, D.C. They live in a two-bedroom apartment downtown now, and it's a co-op, but I was just flabbergasted.
That
wasn't the first one. People are unbelievable what they would ask for.
Well, I guess people are desperate.
Yes, I think they were. But my parents, fortunately, have discovered that they can rent their condo out for a huge amount of money. So they're going to go stay at my sister's house.
If you don't mind my asking, how huge is huge?
How huge is huge? One person is going to potentially rent it for a little bit under $2,000 a night.
Wow.
It's walking distance. It'll be walking distance for them. For whoever rents it, it'll be walking distance to virtually anything they want to do in downtown D.C.
Too large per night. Well, maybe they don't have to clean up for that amount of money, Amy.
Hey, for that amount of money, they can steal all the furniture.
But don't you love it how this was essentially somebody asking if his friend could stay with this person's parents? This is a virtual stranger hookup. I mean, can you imagine having the nerve to ask?
Hey, you know, I have not missed an inauguration since 1950, the late 50s, shall we say. I'm not going. 2 million people is just way too many people in that very, very small city, of which they are going to shut every road down. People are not going to be able to drive in. They're only going to be able to go by subway, and they're not going to get close enough to make it worth their while.
That's why we urge people to listen on the radio, Margaret.
Yeah, I intend to, in fact.
Margaret's absolutely right. I think just aside from the house thing, I've been talking to a lot of people who live here who say, I'm going away for that weekend. I know it's history, but I'm going away. I have a coworker that's actually, she said she's going up to New York to visit friends because it's just going to be too crazy to deal with.
Well, he should rent it out. I mean, look, Washington, D.C., I understand there's been a ruling that the city council ruled something just today or yesterday allowing people to do it, because allowing people to rent out their houses or apartments for those.
I don't think people were asking for permission. I think they were just going ahead and doing it, Margaret.
But no, they were. But apparently there has been, I don't know, I just spoke to my sister, and she said that the
city council acted
to make some kind of rule because some people were being told by their condo boards they couldn't rent it out.
Mm. All right. Well, Margaret, thanks very much. Good luck.
Thank you, and good luck.
Bye-bye. Amy, are you going to come down for the inauguration?
Neil, didn't you get my text?
Okay. The arrow bed's for you, Amy. Thanks very much, Amy. Amy Dickinson, who writes the syndicated column Ask Amy for the Chicago Tribune, joining us on the phone from her home in Ithaca, New York. Again, Happy New Year, Amy.
Thanks, Neil.
And we'd like to thank Veronica Miller, a writer and radio producer. Her article, No Room at the Inn, appeared yesterday on TheRoot.com. She was with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Neil.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.